The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our site at supchina.com. We've got reported stories, essays, and editorials, great explainers and trackers, regular columns, and of course, a growing library of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim peoples in China's Xinjiang region to the tectonic shifts underway as China rolls out what we call the Red New Deal. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. If you've been listening to this podcast in the last several weeks, you'll know that I've got something of a theme going, looking at the different ways we approach understanding China. As with any society, I hope it should go without saying that one vital perspective on it should be its humanities. Without a sense of the role played by the arts and letters, by culture of all brows, as it were, can we really say that we know anything about a society? That's why I was really excited to see a new book by Megan Walsh called The Subplot, What China is Reading and Why It Matters. Immediately, I thought that a conversation with the author would slot right into this series, and on reading the book, I was not at all disappointed. Megan Walsh is a journalist who lived and worked in Beijing for a number of years in the 2000s and early 2010s, studied Chinese literature extensively at SOAS, and has done the English reading world a great service by producing a remarkably slim little volume that nonetheless covers a huge range of Chinese writers from the country's better-known, well-established authors like Mo Yan and Yan Lianke to migrant workers, to genre fiction writers working in pulpier categories like detective or crime fiction and romance, to the science fiction writers like Liu Cixin, Hao Jingfang, and Chen Qiufan, who've drawn quite a bit of attention lately. And also, and this is the really crazy part, to the legions of mostly anonymous writers who churn out just tens of thousands of characters literally a day to feed the insatiable appetite of fans who are mostly commuters, I guess, reading serial stories on their smartphones. And while these are mostly lacking in what one might think of as conventional literary merit, they are certainly popular, and they have been the basis for just about every TV show produced in China and popularized on China's many streaming services in recent years. So just like you need to view China through a bunch of different lenses, you need to view China's literary scene through a full array of genre lenses as well to get a clear picture. And that's what Megan's book, The Subplot, delivers. Megan Walsh, welcome to Cynica.
Thanks so much for having me, Kaiser.
So delighted that you could join. So Megan, like many people who were first exposed to modern Chinese literature, your first love was Eileen Chang, if I'm not mistaken, Zhang Eileen. You wrote extensively while at SOAS about another woman writer, Ding Ling, who was just a hugely, hugely influential author in the mid-1920s, 1930s. But talk about your early exposure to what we would call contemporary Chinese fiction. Who were some of the authors writing, say, from the 80s onward who really first grabbed you?
Yeah, so the first writer that I really actually properly engaged with was Ma Jian. It was around the time of Beijing Coma. I reviewed it while I was working at the Times of London book section. And I also got the opportunity to interview him. And
oh, wow.
He was, you know, just such a firecracker. He really didn't pull any punches. And I found his anger and clarity of expression and ideas incredibly energizing when I spoke to him. And I guess, even though I'd lived in China before that, he was the first author that I properly engaged with in a meaningful sense once I got back. And that's then what knocked me into people like Yen Lianke, who I still would probably say is my favorite from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously Yu Hua and Mo Yan and Su Tong.
Yeah, so those are, you know, five of the biggest writers of that age. But they just sort of represent one corner of the spread of genres that you cover. The sheer number, though, I was sort of blown away by all that you seem to have read. The number of just novels and short stories that you reference in this book of yours is pretty mind-blowing. How long did you spend just reading for this book? And how much of it did you read in the original Chinese as opposed to an English translation?
Yeah, I was worried you were going to ask me that. I went into the reading and researching process with great intentions of reading as much as I possibly could in Chinese, and just very quickly fell to my knees and realized I just couldn't get through it all, especially if I wanted to cover the range and diversity I really wanted to include in the book. So I would say, in the end, quite a small number of books were read in Chinese, and they were exclusively the ones that I couldn't get hold of in translation in any form here.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest, I take my hat off to the very talented translators who've done a really amazing job. It's a sort of labor of love for so many of them, and I relied heavily on their work.
Yeah, there's just such a wonderful core of translators. So I'm doing everything from, you know, worker poetry and worker fiction like Eleanor Goodman's doing, to all those people who were associated with the Paper Republic in Beijing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, sort of old stalwarts like Howard Goldblatt, right? There's a great list of the translators that you sort of tip your hat to toward the end in your acknowledgments. And it's a real who's who.
I'm completely indebted to them. I can't lie.
Yeah, but you did have to read all of this stuff on the web, though, that I can't imagine has been translated yet. That must have been...
Well, I mean, you'd be pleased to hear that some of it has been. So, you know, you can go and check it out. There's also some very devoted translators. Some of them, I think, are extremely young, who do very bad translations of arguably quite bad novels, but you do still get a sense of, you know, the kind of thing that is being read and written online.
Well, maybe the badness of the translation is an accurate reflection of the quality.
Or
of
I'll the just blame the translation.
Yeah. Okay. That's fantastic. I feel a little bit better. I mean, because I would have struggled. I struggle to read in Chinese anything longer than, you know, a couple of pages. So. When I it strikes me always when I look at sort of some of the literature that emerged in the 80s and the 90s, especially, you know, when you look at the literature of the May 4th era all the way up to Yan'an, and you compare it to the literature that you know, we've been talking about just now, you know, the Yan Liukes and the Mo Yans and stuff, it's hard not to see a lot of continuity. There's still a lot of, you know, cultural self-flagellation, I guess you could call it. It's there. It's this loathing and contempt directed in a lot of this celebrated modern literature that we're familiar with at what these writers perceive to be kind of fundamental flaws in the Chinese psyche or in the Chinese character. It seems that May 4th casts a really long shadow. I mean, does it strike you the same way? And what do you think this says about Chinese society, about critical Chinese writers, that these themes seem to be so persistent?
I mean, I don't think that the writers of the 80s and 90s are so preoccupied with the inherent flaws of the Chinese character or society, even though they are very much preoccupied with them. But I do think the thing that links them, or the shadow that has been cast, is the need for writing to serve a purpose, that it carries this burden, this kind of moral burden almost, to reform society, to change it, to expose what is problematic in people's thinking or how society is structured. So I agree, there is a sort of degree of continuity in that sense. But I also think, especially with a writer like Yen Lianke and Yu Hua, also someone as singular as San Xue, I don't think they feel like they are standing on the shoulders of giants. I feel like they have spent a long time honing their craft, figuring out what they feel about their past, about China, about society itself. And their work is entirely unique to them, really. I think the problem seems to be more for the generations after them who are really struggling to find a voice in this new ascendant China.
Yeah, that's interesting. It feels like prior to Yan'an, prior to the 1940s, there was that a real sense of that burden. You know, you had to write for national salvation or national enlightenment. You had to, you know, to do all that soul searching, and to not have taken up that mantle would have just sort of marked you as frivolous. To have not written politically during the years of high Maoism would have been not just dangerous, but you know, it would have been seen dismissed as you know, bourgeois, right, and frivolous. Mm-hmm. Again, and then in the aftermath, once again, I mean, if you're not writing to the you know, to the devastation culturally left by those years of high Maoism, so what you're saying is that now that they don't feel burdened necessarily by politics, they're struggling to find a voice. That's kind of tragic, huh?
I have really sensed that. You know, I'm sort of reading various blogs and interviews on things like China Writer, which is, you know, one of the kind of state-backed sites for young writers. And a lot of them, when they're asked about what characterizes their fiction, is they feel like they don't have anything important to say. They feel like because they haven't suffered in the same way as their parents, because they have had a better life, they somehow are like struggling to find a subject and arguably their own sort of subjectivity while writing. And I get the sense that's something they've slightly inherited. They've been kind of told these things, and it's part of being, I guess, kind of loyal to that discourse, that they need to not be thinking about themselves. They need to be thinking about the fate of those worse off than them, which incidentally I think is a really interesting influence on Chinese fiction, which we don't really have in the West in the same way. Just this imperative to think about the fate of others, you know.
Yeah. That's maybe why so much of it focuses on the subaltern then.
Yeah, I think, and it has since May 4th, you know, it's always been about the subaltern in some sense, as it was under Mao. I think the 80s weren't about the sub. I mean, I think everybody felt like they were themselves the victims of very difficult times and needed to sort of sublimate those experiences or grapple with their own actions, maybe. But I think now, because there is this sort of narrative of economic uplift, young people are really sort of struggling to justify ever writing about their own life. Hmm. And I think that there is something quite sad about that.
So I wonder if they feel that pressure, not just sort of domestically, not just within the Chinese kind of writerly milieu, but also maybe from outside of China. I mean, because I can't help but notice that there is kind of an expectation that we in the West tend to saddle Chinese writers with as well. I mean, there is a conventional wisdom, I would think. I mean, by my lights, it's something like, you know, the only literature worthy of the name is the stuff that is overtly critical, if not flat out dissident, right? And then this kind of claim that, look, there simply isn't any decent literature coming out of China right now because censorship, right? But what you're painting is a picture of, I mean, it's different though. I mean, it doesn't seem like necessarily censorship is what's keeping them from writing, although I'm sure it's a factor. How would you tackle that? Do you feel like with this book you're able to transcend the Western gaze, as it were, and manage to talk about what China is reading or what China's writers are writing on their own terms?
Yeah. I mean, that's something which I think I've had to sort of grapple with quite a long time myself. I remember first sort of going to China, I think in 2012, in my capacity as a journalist, mm-hmm. and interviewing a ton of writers in a big room. And I just instantly felt like I needed to ask about censorship and to ask them about how they deal with it. And it felt like a brave thing for me to do. And the minute I did it, I just felt a bit rubbish about the question. I felt quite ashamed that I'd asked them.
Well, but in your defense, I mean, that is it should be a factor. I mean, it's something
factor. Yeah. I think it is. I mean, I really do think it is one of the biggest challenges China faces for a sort of thriving cultural scene. I think what was shameful for me was that I had just walked in assuming that I was sort of there to bring this topic to the table and finally have some kind of constructive debate about censorship or something, quite ignoring the fact that Chinese writers have lived with it in various degrees for many, many decades. And they know what they're dealing with, and they have all chosen very different ways of dealing with that side of things. Some very innovatively, some quite depressingly and obediently. But I still feel like it's their choice how they want to deal with those ultimately sort of sets of notes in terms of how they engage with the artistic process. And I just felt a little bit cheap, I think. You know, I haven't asked that question again. And lo and behold, the writers who want to talk about it, they bring it up pretty quickly. So, yeah, you know.
I imagine. I mean, it's not just in film, though. I mean, I feel like in other genres of Chinese art, I remember in the mid-2000s talking to somebody who ran a major European film festival. He was at my house. We were having drinks. It was a little gathering of people. And he told me flat out that they were only interested in basically films that couldn't be screened in China. And I said, is that just the stick? I mean, is that what you do? You go out? And that would have made sense to me. But no, he says, no. He thought that that it was not possible for a film to have merit, you know, literary merit, or, you know, merit as a film, unless it were explicitly banned in China.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that is still there in Western treatment? I mean, let's go back and talk about when Mo Yan won the Nobel Prize in Literature. He came in for a real beating internationally by a lot of people who thought that just because he was sort of part of the literary establishment, that therefore his writing couldn't have merit.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of people came to his defense for the same reason.
Yeah.
You know, it was a difficult thing for a lot of people to understand. You know, he'd recently just copied out the Yan'an edicts about, you know, how writers should write for the party and things in public. And he compared censorship to being akin to airport security or something, you know. And I think what people had sort of misunderstood was that Chinese writers operate in sort of a multifaceted way a lot of the time, and they have a sort of political public persona, and then they have their art, which often has no relation with the person. So there's a big separation between the art and the writing. And a lot, I mean, I remember Sheng Kui defended him and said he's being attacked for his politics, not for his writing. They're not the same thing. Right. And that's quite hard for us to understand, I think. You know, we increasingly actually, you know, read things knowing what we think of somebody's politics, you know, and if we find out that their politics aren't to our taste, it'll definitely influence how we read their work.
Yeah.
And in China, I think a lot of people keep a very clear distance between those two things.
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly less tenable to do that in the United States. I mean, just I think of J.K. Rowling, for example. Nobody reads her stuff the same now. I mean, everyone's sort of looking for the sort of anti-trans subtext in everything she writes now. Yeah. So you have a real fondness for Yan Liangke. He's the author of books like Serve the People and The Day the Sun Died and Ding Village. Those are, you know, his best-known books outside of China. What is it that you love about Yan's work, and what would you recommend? Where would you recommend somebody start with his fiction?
Yeah, the reason I like it, it's quite hard to articulate why I like him so much. I just am constantly drawn to the worlds he creates. He has the four books is a particularly brilliant example of his, he calls it mytho-realism, his type of genre. It's set in a re-education camp, and it's a kind of Rashomon-style approach to events. Within the re-education camp, there's a kind of biblical narrative. There's an author who tells two stories, one where he's kind of dobbing in all of his inmates, the other where he's trying to kind of make amends for being such an asshole to them all. And then a really petulant child who's kind of a stand-in for the leader. The thing that's so like captivating about his work is, this may not appeal to a lot of people, but I feel like it's really imbued with a kind of like an illuminating sadness.
Mm.
It's deeply humane and beautifully written. And also he creates worlds which I haven't come across in any fiction anywhere else in the world, really, from any other writers. It does feel unique to China. It feels unique to Chinese history without in any way caricaturing it or turning it into something that's sort of stereotypical in any way.
Oh, so the four books, I haven't actually read that. Is there an English translation of that?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's translated by Carlos Rojas or Royas. I don't know how his...
Carlos, so, yeah, you know, he lives up the street from me.
Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, he's an incredible translator, and he's a very good fit, I think, with Yan Lianke, and always just, you know... anyway, it feels like the right fit for Yan Lianke.
Well, Carlos and Eileen, if you're listening, apologies for not knowing that you know this. I'll go out in atonement. I'll go out and buy a copy right away. So I'm wondering, though, do you ever feel like we cut Chinese writers too much slack? I mean, let's be honest here. Half of the literary devices that they deploy, the parables and the metaphors, are just so on the nose sometimes that they would be dismissed with, you know, bored eye rolls by any New York editor were they submitted by an American writing in English. I mean, how are they able? Because this is a constant feeling that I have. It's like, really? This is your metaphor? I mean, it's like, could you just not put this gigantic sign blinking and pointing at it?
Who are you thinking of in particular?
It's just so many times that I've seen this. I mean, okay, so we can talk about Ma Jian, right? We can talk about Yu Hua. We can talk about lots of them who do this.
Mm. I mean, I think Ma Jian is an interesting one in that I think I get the sense, and I say this sort of respectfully, that living abroad for a long time, he's been sort of held captive almost by the need to be so overtly political. You know, he really wants to take aim. And also, I think that's often what happens when you're at a distance from China, that you sort of start seeing it in a more and more kind of
binary,
metaphorical binary. Yeah. Well, I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I really love his fiction, by the way. In a way, his metaphors don't bother me. They feel like suited to how angry he feels and how he... And then I think in terms of the kind of eye-rolling stuff, I definitely come across it a lot with a lot of the younger writers I've read who are just sort of, you know, forgivably trying to cut their teeth and like figure out how to write and stuff. But I never really feel it with the writers, you know, born in the 50s and 60s. Mm.
Yeah, that's good. You know, this is a very subjective thing, obviously. I was just wondering about your opinion. I wonder whether, you know, that might be the case for somebody like Ma Jian writing from outside of China. I've often felt like I'm really impressed with the subtlety that you have to use when you're writing in China under the gaze of the censors to get away with it. I mean, maybe it forces you to be a little less direct and on the nose.
Definitely. And I think there's also something about being on the nose, which isn't, it's certainly not true to what life is like living in China. You can't just say whatever the hell you want. And so to write something on the nose is also not in any, you know, in many ways representative of that experience.
So it's got to be liberating to do that.
It's liberating to, but I also think that there is, it's the kind of, I guess, the artistic process where you are trying to, through sort of perception, insight, and through a long period of time, you know, you spend years writing a story, find like acceptance for the truth of things in an interesting way rather than just stating them outright.
Yeah.
And
that's what writing's all about.
That's what so many of them do. That's what writing's all about.
So it feels like, I mean, and I think we are all in agreement here that politics is kind of inescapable when writing about Chinese literature. And in part, that's because, you know, in China, the party since the Yan'an Forum in 1941 has made it very clear that, you know, it's got a purpose, right? And this has been revived now under Xi Jinping. I mean, they've reemphasized this once again. Is there any literature that you looked at for this book where you felt that you, as a critic, could relax the political muscle a bit and just take it in without the political framing? I mean, surely there are genres that get consumed in China without the reader being forced to confront the politics, right? Maybe?
Yeah. I mean, yes, in that, you know, if you look at the vast web novel industry.
We will.
We will. You know, they are... It's almost defined by how apolitical it is. You know, there's it's there's nothing that can peg it to real life, really, to real experiences, to real people. It's pure escapism. And then I think that the question of whether something cannot be political is an interesting one, and I don't honestly know the answer, but I do think in a country where there are imperatives that you have to sort of write on behalf of others or on behalf of the collective or on behalf of the party, individual viewpoints or a sort of unique subjectivity is just sort of by virtue of itself political.
Right.
And that is what makes it interesting as well.
The decision to be apolitical is itself political.
And I think the government feel that too. Yeah, no, they do. Think, you know, yeah.
So I mean, I think being able to write wholly separately from politics is really only a privilege that writers in the prosperous liberal states of the West have really enjoyed traditionally, and Japan and being places that enjoy political freedom. So we were talking earlier, and you said something interesting that I thought might be worth unpacking a bit here. How this is changing also in the Anglophone world, especially in the years since Trump and Brexit, since 2016. Can you talk a little bit about that idea and expand it? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I think I've really felt, as have a lot of people, I'm not saying anything new, that, you know, since the Trump administration, since Brexit, you know, the rise of right-wing populism in various European countries, there has been a kind of a very uncomfortable awakening for a lot of people that we're not on the same page as each other. Right. There isn't a sort of an agreed reality. And I think even the New York Times ran a piece, you know, at the sort of New Year, which is like America's reality crisis. And I think, you know, I remember sort of reading like Salman Rushdie saying that he thought people wrote magical realism when there was a sense that nobody was on the same page. And I think Chinese writers have been doing that for a very long time. There's been a very clear master narrative. And then in my experience, most literature, even if it's trying to adhere to that master narrative, doesn't do it because it's kind of impossible when one person is just, you know, hammering away and writing something.
Right,
you know,
right,
other
right.
stuff comes out. But, you know, China has a lot of very interesting, sort of strange, wacky genres. And I think we will increasingly see that as our previously agreed narratives are being often quite rightly deconstructed. They're being reinterrogated, rewritten. And people won't be able to just write, you know, middle class family stories anymore and feel like it's part of contemporary society in the same way.
Megan, we were chatting the other day and we both kind of went down this sort of memory lane, this nostalgia trip about the literary scene in Beijing, the city where we both lived for a very long time. For those of our listeners who weren't lucky enough to have been able to experience that firsthand, I was only kind of glancingly familiar with it myself, being kind of, you know, a literary tyro. Can you paint a picture of what it was like in Beijing in the literature scene in the aughts?
Oh God, I wish I was more embedded into it than I was. Obviously, it began for me with hanging out a lot at the Bookworm.
Oh God, I miss the Bookworm.
I know. But, you know, I didn't speak great Chinese and, you know, they offered bilingual talks and I got to know a lot of writers and writing through there. And also, I loved the people who worked in the shop. You know, they would recommend really interesting books for me. And then I think by extension, there was a sense that a lot of the bookshops that were flourishing in various cities, actually not just Beijing, were full of real sort of literary enthusiasts. And I spent a lot more time, more and more time in bookstores when I was there. They used to be the ones that would sell, you know, knockoff DVDs of art house movies, which I would stock up on back in the day. But, you know, they tended to also overlap with, you know, a lot of the artists who are sort of working out on, I forget which ring road now, but, you know, we go to their kind of openings and things and various writers and books being sold there at the same time. And it genuinely felt more exciting being there than being here. And I missed
Here's
it desperately.
Here's London, right, for you right now.
Yeah. I shouldn't say that. It's, you know, we have a flourishing publishing scene here, but it felt kind of manageable and exciting at the same time.
I know what you mean. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I love that overlap. I mean, people who are in film, you know, playwrights, musicians, visual artists, all kind of gathering. It was a real scene in the truest sense.
Yeah.
Those were the days. So, Megan, as much as I enjoyed what you wrote about the more writerly writers, I have to say the chapter that really grabbed me, that really fascinated, well, fascinated and horrified me was your chapter on web fiction. I mean, it's something that seems pretty unique to China. I mean, certainly in scale, even if some of the genre conventions are borrowed from other East Asian countries. What should we know about Chinese web fiction, about the economics of it, about, you know, who produces it, who consumes it, and how the government reacts to this?
Yeah, so I think internet fiction started off as a very sort of niche and exciting thing with Murong Shuishun, I think, writing stuff. Yeah, and Annie Baobei and people like that. But they quickly sort of fell by the wayside. They were writing things that weren't welcome, and they took up writing elsewhere.
Imagine Murong Shuishun writing something that's not welcome.
Exactly. They unfortunately lost their footing pretty quickly. And it was just replaced by this, you know, who would have thought it, but growing and vast industry of fantasy writers who, you know, churn out sometimes 10, 20,000 words a day, and people would check in and read each chapter each day in a kind of modern day Dickensian serialization process. And they have absolutely exploded. There's now 24 million titles available.
My God.
430 million active readers. And
that's a third of the population of China. I mean, that's insane.
Apparently. I mean, again, who knows, but as you probably see on commutes, you just see people scrolling through these novels. And I sort of can't believe how popular they are, really. Not only because they're generally not great, but because, you know, people are in this sort of digital age, people are still reading. People are still like tuning in every day to like devour stories. And that's kind of impressive as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think they've become this sort of clash of, it's the sort of main fault line in China between sort of government and big business. And they seem to sort of represent that big clash where it's a way for young people to make money if their IP is sold for, you know, one of these TV shows or an anime, a manga adaptation. But as a result, they've become really popular and the government can't stand it. So there's you know, two big sort of titans fighting it out to control the content now.
And who are those? Just the industry itself? Or is there one or two companies that are sort of taking up the banner?
Yeah, it's a Tencent who own the sort of most of the online reading platforms now. And the government. Like, yeah, exactly.
Hey, so I'm curious, though. You know, in the United States or in the English-speaking world, we've seen things, you know, we have a gigantic fan fiction phenomenon, and it's related, right? A lot of this stuff starts off as sort of fan fiction based on a favorite anime or manga series, based on characters from a beloved wuxia or xianxia kind of novel. We've seen this in the States. You had like all this Harry Potter fan fiction. You had, of course, the success of books like 50 Shades of Grey, which started off as Twilight fan fiction, I suppose. I've never actually read it at all. I mean, you know, it sounds horrifyingly bad.
I've never read it either.
But, you know, this is like, it's like this phenomenon happening just every day, right? Every day some new piece of web literature is picked up to be turned into a movie. I mean, I know my sister-in-law was a very successful screenwriter. Wrote a lot of, you know, well-loved Chinese television series. But now, she says, basically they've been replaced. I mean, that they do all day is scour the web and see what's trending in this, you know, free-spending demographic. And they don't know that they've got a surefire hit. I mean, that's depressing, right? I mean, it can't be doing good things for literature.
No, I don't think it is, unfortunately. And it's also not doing great things for the writers themselves. Right. I think they are all, you know, there's so many of them, and they're all kind of given these incentives that they might get snapped up. But as a result of trying to keep eyeballs, to keep people reading, they are reduced to sort of either having to pander to this very active audience, you know, who are telling them what they want to happen, or plagiarism, copying other stories, just to sort of literally get the words out each day. And so they really do all share quite sort of unique algorithmic traits that feel really predictable and you know, a product of it being kind of turned into a sort of grotesque business. You know, it's just a huge industry of free market fiction, which is about economic leniency and still kind of avoiding all cultural sort of taboos or restrictions, although not so much anymore. But anyway,
yeah. That is the bright side of it, the silver lining, as it were, that there's a lot of queer themes in it. There's a lot of what they call BL, or you know, that's, I suppose, the English word, but the Danmei fiction. Can you talk about Danmei fiction and what role that plays in this larger genre of internet fiction?
Yeah, so Danmei fiction, it's boys' love fiction, written mainly by female writers. And it sort of came over from Japan, I don't know when, very popular there, but it's become, I think, the most popular form of romance in China for young girls to read. I mean, I remember going to Hong Kong to a sort of Comic Con exhibition where I was trying to sort of get some manga to read and some comics. And I think three girls told me the only romance you need to read about is Danmei. Like, that's what all girls want to read. Mm. And the theory is that it reveals that a lot of girls are still feeling dissatisfied with the role that women have to play in society. And they love reading about two lovers who are completely free of any kind of incumbent obstacles that face girls.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, the other thing worth mentioning is the minute you read it or you watch it, you just sort of stop noticing that it's BL really, and it's just a romance, you know, it's a story that you're just in.
What about, I mean, there isn't as much lesbian themed fiction. I mean, there's some, but it doesn't seem to be nearly as popular. What do you suppose is the reason for that?
Yeah, I think it's because lesbian fiction in particular seems to be very quickly censored and banned. I think there's a few male writers who have really wanted to include like lesbian love stories, and that's what's got their novels taken down. Whereas, you know, there's quite a sort of famous writer called Priest, and her novel Guardians was about two sort of super sleuths who were in love with each other. And for the TV show, they just got a sort of straightening up, and it was turned into, you know, socialist brotherly love. So there was something, you know, which has become a bit of a like joke now. You just kind of have homoerotic undertones, but it's all about kind of commitment to friendship and loyalty to each other in the mode of kind of socialist heroes. So I think as long as there's no sex at all, the government have been sort of happy with close male relationships in the way that for some reason two girls is absolutely not okay.
I remember 20 years ago or so, I was approached by the director Stanley Kwan from Hong Kong, and I ended up subtitling a wonderful film that he did called Lan Yu. But it turns out, and I didn't know this at the time, but that was web fiction originally.
Oh, really?
I think it was. I mean, it was like I can't remember the name of it now, of the original novel, but, you know, it was like the first big sort of gay love story out of China.
That's not the Beijing Comrades.
Yeah, it is. Beijing Comrades. Yeah. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
I guess it had its origins as like a sort of underground piece of web fiction.
Yeah, I didn't realize it started off as web fiction. I know it was, you know, the author is still unknown, still anonymous. And I think Stanley Kwan, didn't he think that it was Wang Xiaobo?
Yeah, he thought it was Wang Xiaobo. Yeah. Which makes sense to me. I mean, you know, if people don't know, he's a wonderful satirist who got really popular in the early 90s, I guess. The golden age, the silver age, these books.
I think a lot of people thought that it might have been written by a sympathetic female friend. So that's the other theory of why Danmei has been so popular in China, is that a lot of girls are very close friends with young gay boys who have not been able to express themselves, and they've written these love stories on their behalf. That's one of the theories.
Those are the old. I really enjoyed subtitling as a gig, because, you know, if you just kind of timed it right, you kind of knew when all the directors of indie films would be desperate to get their films into competition. Invariably, they had already asked some friend of theirs, a Chinese person who spoke some English, to do the subtitling, and then, you know, they showed it to an English or American friend, and they were like ghastly and they immediately had to scramble to find somebody who could do subs quickly, and so you could charge them kind of extortionate rent for.
Sounds great.
No, it was a great gig. So let's move on to science fiction, which is, I think, is fantastic. I was commiserating with you not long before this conversation about how cagey certain science fiction writers are about talking about the Chinese-ness. I ask everybody, you know, what, if anything, makes Chinese fiction, science fiction, distinctly Chinese? And nobody seems to want to answer me. Can you give it a shot? Is there something that you think is sort of a common themes in Chinese science fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think we might be in some agreement in that, and it's really pegged to Liu Zixin, whose sci-fi is truly sort of hopeful and optimistic. It's kind of, it's epic, but it's devoted to, you know, an exploration of the stars, essentially, and seeing what's out there and embracing the unknown. I mean, I think the other thing that makes Chinese science fiction distinctive really is it's quite, as far as I can tell, quite an elite genre, in that it's written by very highly educated, impressive scientists and engineers and physicists. And they're all using kind of very kind of exciting, cutting edge ideas, but writing quite often sort of Ray Bradbury-esque and simple tales about what the future might hold. And with that comes a sort of a genuine degree of optimism about where technology might take us, and AI and deep learning programs, and even sort of imagining, and not in a kind of negative way, the possibility that machines could possess more humanity than we do. And that could be a sort of an exciting thing. And I don't really feel, you know, so much Chinese fiction is really dystopian, and sort of strangely, a lot of it sci-fi isn't.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I've made that observation too about the kind of lack of really heavily dystopian science fiction in coming out of China. I mean, the laugh line I get when I talk about this is that, you know, we're in our Black Mirror phase here in the West, and China's still in its Star Trek phase, you know, to boldly go where no man has gone before. That's fantastic. I do agree with you. A long time ago, I interviewed this philosopher named Anna Greenspan. I think it's like in 2013 or 2014. She's a Canadian academic. She had written this great book called Shanghai Future, Modernity Remade. And she talked about how Chinese people seem to have just a different posture toward futurity than people from North America or Western Europe. And since that conversation, I mean, the profundity and the truth of what she had pointed out has just gotten clearer and clearer to me. I've come to believe that it makes a significant difference in the way that people interact with technology. The way they imagine a future, obviously, is represented in sci-fi. Science fiction is, right? It's about imagining a future and the technology so integral to it. What about, you know, is there a Chinese politics in Chinese science fiction? In other words, like, have you read books where China as a nation state or China as a civilization or whatever is projected into a future? And what are the kind of roles that it has in that imagined future?
I mean, the first person who springs to mind is Bao Shu, who's a sort of, I think he started off writing Liu Zixin fan fiction.
Oh, interesting. But
he's one of the few writers to have got into a bit of trouble with the stories he's written. One of them is called, I think, Songs from Ancient Earth, where he imagines a future where the universe is, I think there's a spaceship has crashed on a distant star, and it's been sort of indoctrinated with Red songs. You know, the only thing that's kind of the only thing that sort of remains from Earth, that they're all kind of computers, as far as I can tell, on this spaceship. All that remains of Earth is Red songs and Red culture and Red history. And you know, he sees that as a sort of a damning thing. You know, we can't.
Remember what I was saying about on the nose metaphors, right?
Yeah, exactly. There you go. But I think one thing that, again, and I'm drawing on writers that people probably know quite well, sort of Hao Jianfeng and Liu Zixin, there is the thinking, they tend to think about the world not in terms of just China, but as a world having to come together through something. You know, it's quite sort of in keeping with the official Olympics message, but I think they do dare to imagine it. It's not something that They don't seem to be the kind of the arch nationalists and patriots that want to just sort of see China sort of taking over the world. And, you know, they're just sort of interested in what kind of partnerships different cultures will be making to bring the world together.
That in itself is very hopeful.
Yeah.
I like that. So it's such a short book. I mean, there are things that we haven't talked about yet. I would love to talk a little bit about maybe, you know, the crime and legal genre of fiction, sort of the equivalent of the John Grisham or what have you. But there are probably lots of other genres and certainly lots of writers that you would have included had you been given more space. Before we talk about what you had left out, let's talk about a couple more things that you did include, including, you know, these different... I would say genre fiction is really important to understanding a culture. I mean, if I were looking at the United States, right, from some, like, imaginary, distant perspective, I wouldn't think it would be fair if all we read was, like, you know, Donna Tartt and Don DeLillo, right? And we would have to read Danielle Steele. We'd have to read, you know, John Grisham or I was horrified at, like, best-selling authors in the United States over the last 50 years or something. And it was, I mean, I was, you know, Dan Brown or whatever. It's like,
but yeah, don't check bestseller charts for hope about the arts, I would say.
No, I was actually doing that just so that I was curious, you know, like if you had done the same exercise from China looking at the United States, what you would have selected. But you did include some genre fiction writer. Can you talk about, you know, like I said, the kind of legal genre? And some of that has been really successful. Like, you know, In the Name of the People became a wildly popular and very good, I have to say, television show.
Yeah. So I think Joel Mason wrote In the Name of the People as an online novel, started off writing it. And it was kind of tied in with the anti-corruption campaign that was launched. I forget when it was. You'll know better than me.
Yeah, 2013, 2014.
There you go. And, you know, did you watch the TV show?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And I think the thing that really seemed to capture people's imagination was they really wanted to see corruption being tackled head on. And it was really pleasing and really exciting to see, you know, the sort of justice system cracking down on these things, which they felt was pervasive and also untouchable for many, many years. And I think a lot of people sort of see it as the government kind of playing a bit of a blinder because it looked like they were kind of finally allowing corruption narratives to be screened or published. And it looked like they were the ones who were like kicking its ass, basically. But, you know, as you say, it was also really enjoyable and a lot of fun for people to watch, primarily because they needed it. It was like a form of catharsis, I think. That was a huge hit a few years ago.
Yeah. What are the other maybe surprise genres that are big? I mean, you know, here I know what to sort of expect when I walk into a bookstore. I know, like, you know, there's going to be the kind of hard-boiled detective novel. There's going to be the bodice ripper romance novels, the Harlequin, whatever. I mean, there's, you know, pretty established genres. There's going to be the fantasy and the sci-fi, and, you know, we all know the difference between fantasy and sci-fi. What is there in China that we don't have in the West?
Yeah, so I actually didn't really include much of this, and I didn't read much of it as workplace fiction, which is about the kind of cutthroat office politics of people straight out of university trying to get ahead in the office. And it's really, really popular. People find it very, I think, consoling to sort of, one, get tips or just, you know, find ways of at least acknowledging that these things happen and it sucks. And then there was it was a really fantastic novel called The Civil Servant's Notebook, which was translated by Eric Abrahamson. And it's really funny. It's about like a mayoral, it's a mayoral politics, basically. And it has staplers talking to staples, you know, philosophizing about the nature of who's better off and how you get ahead is by sort of shouting thief and stealing something from someone's pocket, you know. And it's just really kind of down and dirty and gritty. And the government kind of waved it through as sort of an example of how you shouldn't behave. It wasn't sort of seen as brutal satire of what does exist. But it's a really brilliant book. I'm not sure how popular it was, but I would hope it was very popular.
Workplace fiction. I know there was a book called Dulala or something like that.
Yeah, right.
It was made into a film by Xu Jinglei, who's a very, very talented actress and director, called Go Lala Go or something like that. But
That's right.
Is that what we're talking about? That's workplace
Absolutely.
Fiction.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. That's you've hit the nail on the head. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I wonder, do we have that in? I guess I've never read anything like that. But I mean, 9 to 5, I suppose.
It's kind of Ally McBeal. That sort of stuff. It feels quite similar to that.
Oh, great. Yeah. So it's not entirely alien.
No.
Yeah. Fantastic. So what about stuff that you couldn't include that you would have really loved to? I mean, because this is only 100 pages, and I mean that is, I should say, because of this particular imprint. It's Columbia Global Reports, which they're slim little volumes. And I've read a few of them; they're very, very good. What would you have included? Who would you have included if you had been given more space?
Yeah, so there's actually just a lot of young writers that I think are really impressive, but because of I guess the limitations, as you say, of the length, they just didn't sort of find a natural home in many ways. There's a kind of a whole sort of new generation of surrealists who are really exciting and interesting.
Hmm.
And it almost feels sort of quite appropriate that they didn't fit in to the book itself, that, they are a kind of niche group of writers, but I think they are representative of, I guess, how young people are trying to sort of grapple with this idea that they don't know what to be and they don't know where to be. And
it's kind of a common condition for young people.
Yeah, it is. It's a common, but I remember reading, is it Shuji Yen, who owns One Way Street Books. But I remember him saying he really wished that he could sort of come across young poets who just felt lost. And this was a couple of maybe 10 years ago. And I think there's just a lot of them now, a lot of people who are just young people a bit lost, and a lot of them are sublimating that and writing really kind of great fiction as a result. And then there are kind of other writers, like there's an absolutely amazing writer called Qian Jianan, who I think is actually now studying at Iowa doing an MFA.
Oh, that's a good program.
It's a great program, and she's an incredibly talented writer. She wrote a book called People Who Don't Eat Eggs. It hasn't been translated yet, but I absolutely loved it. And in the end, there just wasn't enough space for me to devote what I wanted to it. But I would highly recommend people read a lot of her English. She writes in English also. She's a very, very illuminating writer. Just check her out online.
Yeah, although as a person who eats too many eggs, I don't know if I could. That's fantastic. Megan, what a treat it's been to talk to you. I mean, I highly recommend this book for anyone who wants to plunge into the world of literature in China. And again, I think it really ties in with this theme that we've been doing about thinking about China, because I think, the lens of humanities is one that we do not apply often enough when we think about China. And it's super eye-opening, and it's a fun and very, very easy read, and you'll learn a ton. So congrats on the book, which is, again, it's just out like this week in the U.S. In the U.K., still have to wait another couple of months. So thanks so much. There's also, by the way, chapters in there that we didn't get to, for example, about Tibetan and Xinjiang-themed literature or Mongolian-themed. I mean, there's a whole kind of scathing takedown of a lot of the stuff that, what's his name, the wolf totem guy.
Jianrong.
Yeah. Jianrong, yeah. But yeah, it's a fantastic little read, and I highly recommend it. So speaking of recommendations, let us move on to recommendations. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. I mean, remember that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like the work that we're doing with Seneca or with any of the other shows in the network, the best thing you can do to support us is to subscribe to SubChina Access, our daily newsletter. It's just a fantastic compilation with commentary from our own Jeremy Goldcorn and his crack team. So check it out, and you'll be doing us a great service if you subscribe. There's always really good discount rates available if you look. So let's move on to recommendations. Megan, what do you have for us?
The first thing I'd like to recommend is a book by Yi Yun Lee, who most people have probably heard of. She's a Chinese writer who moved from China to the US, I think, in the late 90s to study as an immunologist. And she turns out she's sort of one of the finest writers in English anywhere in the last 20 years, I would say. So any of her novels or short stories are worth reading. But the book I want to recommend is Dear Friend from My Life, I Write to You in My Life. And it's a kind of love letter to reading, that the authors that have got her through periods of depression, but also made her the writer that she is. But I also think for me, it was a really important book because it was also about the importance of reading out of your own cultural sphere. They're mainly Irish writers. You know, she loves William Trevor and John McGregor, but also people like Turgenev and things. But she's such a kind of incredible writer, penetrating and rationed, and it's unlike anything I've ever read, really. And so I would highly recommend people check it out. And I have one others.
Yeah, please go.
The New Zealand singer-songwriter, Aldous Harding, who has a new album out. And I haven't listened to that yet, but her last three albums are really odd and really brilliant. And you could check out her music video, The Barrel, just for a little idea of what she's like. But I think she's great.
Oh, fantastic. That sounds like I'll definitely check that out. So my recommendation is When You Finish Saving the World by Jesse Eisenberg, who's a very talented writer, actor, comic. He was in the network, the Social Network, right? You all know he played Mark Zuckerberg in that. In this, it's a weird thing. It's an Audible original. This kind of medium is kind of difficult to describe. He plays a guy named Nathan, who's a kind of slightly non-neurotypical, kind of brilliant guy, who's a new father. And he's having a great deal of difficulty connecting emotionally with his infant son, Ziggy. The first section, I'm going to call it an audio epistolary drama. So Nathan's recording a kind of diary into his iPhone that his therapist has asked him to do, just like to record his thoughts into his iPhone and send them along. So in these audio missives, we learn all about his relationship with his wife, Rachel, who is a very different person, kind of a moral crusader, do-gooder. Then it jumps forward suddenly to the year 2035, and we hear from his teenage son, this kid Ziggy. And it's funny because the world that he builds, you know, he's not talking into an iPhone. He's talking to an AI counselor during these sessions that he's been assigned to complete because he's physically attacked another student. And then, he creates this whole very believable kind of social media world, and a world where people are like creating music and selling it to, he keeps talking about, you know, he's got a big audience in Lijiang, China, in Yunnan. It's very funny. He's like a singer-songwriter. But he's also, he's a jerk in a lot of ways. He's kind of like nakedly capitalistic and stuff, and doesn't get along with his parents. But he has this whole vocabulary of oddball, you know, new 2035 teenage slang. And the actor is really great. This kid named Finn Wolfhard, who was in Stranger Things. And then there's the Rachel section. So it's three parts. And then the Rachel section is, she's voiced by the actress in the film Booksmart, Caton Deaver, I guess, Deaver. And she's recorded into a cassette recorder back in like the early 2000s in tapes that she sent to her pre-Nathan boyfriend who is serving in Afghanistan. And it starts off as this sort of manic comedy, you know, Jesse Eisenberg, he's very, very funny. By the end of it, you realize he's actually brought it all home and gotten, you know, pretty profound and sentimental, but has let you kind of draw, connect dots. It's just the pieces fit together really nicely without being wedged in. It's not a perfect performance, but it's damn good, and it's really original. I've never come across anything quite like it, and the voice actors are just, they have to be heard to believe, they're amazing. They're so talented. So that's my recommendation. Apparently they're making a movie out of it, which I can safely assume is going to ruin it, because this is definitely meant to be consumed in audio form. It's called When You Finish Saving the World, and it's actually free if you're an Audible subscriber, so check it out. Megan, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed myself.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what comes out of you next. What do you have something something great planned? I mean, you just published this book, so I shouldn't ask you that, but.
It's the killer question. I have no idea.
Good. Well, relax. You know, go. You know, take a vacation somewhere and enjoy yourself. You've earned it. You've earned it. Hopefully, we'll have you back on again soon for whatever. Well, I'll come up with some excuse. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, thanks for having me, Kaiser.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We would be delighted if you'd drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, or just as good, give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.